Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Just one guest today, the labor organizer and writer Jane McAlevey. Jane spent many years organizing, first as an environmentalist and later with the labor movement. The new Republican governor of Illinois, Bruce Rauner, a former hedge fund guy, is trying to gut public sector unions in that state in ways very reminiscent of what Scott Walker did in Wisconsin a few years ago. And before you say, oh, Republicans, it must be pointed out that the Democratic mayor of Chicago, Obama crony Rahm Emanuel, is doing pretty much the same thing. And as Jane McAlevey writes in an article called We Need Syriza in Illinois on the Nation's website, Rauner's attack is going largely unnoticed by the national left and, sad to say, labor movement. Many radicals, equally sad to say, are indifferent to the fate of the labor movement because they see it as an ossified and insular remnant of yesteryear, irrelevant to broader progressive struggles. This is very wrong for reasons that Jane McAlevey will explain very shortly. Her book about her union experience, which is a mix of memoir, analysis, and advice, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell, was published by Verso in 2012. Jane McAlevey. Good morning, Jane. We've got a new Republican Midwestern governor on the march, Bruce Rauner in Illinois. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Bruce Rauner, by the way, is a private equity manager. He's a hedge fund manager. That's his life work. Last year, he made $60 million alone. And by the way, to get elected, which we could argue he bought his election, he spent $27.6 million of his private money, and then an additional about $30 million, outspending the Democrats by over $30 million. That's who Rauner is. That's sort of the new strategy, is to take these billionaires and insert them into the governor's races. And it's hard to beat someone who's going to outspend you 2-1.
Especially if your opposition is rather demobilized. He's got an agenda, a very explicit agenda. It's, what is it? It's austerity plus, right?
Yeah, I mean, I essentially argue that he's essentially going to try and turn Illinois into Greece, but with really less idyllic weather. He is hell-bent on creating austerity in the state of Illinois. And here's the evidence. In 2011, two small tax increases were put through wisely, by the way, to stave off, a huge crisis in that state. And the tax increases in 2011, as the progressives often unfortunately do, were called temporary. And they were set to expire when? Now. This is why the governor's race became so important in the state of Illinois. So the 2011 temporary tax increases took individual rates from 3 to 5% and corporate rates from 4.7 to 7%. The first act of the new governor, Rauner, was to let them expire. Now, 3 weeks later, we hear that the state has a fiscal crisis coming, and that's going to be the excuse to gut workers' pensions, to gut a unique child care program that the state of Illinois actually created in the last few years. And by the way, it was the union movement that helped create a child care program that serves who? Low-income working mothers. So what he's doing is he's sort of smash-mouth-talking unions, this new governor. But what he's actually doing is creating an austerity program. It's completely manufactured. All they had to do was extend tax rates. The political work, right, the hard work of raising the taxes happened in 2011. All they had to do was extend them. Even we could have made a rationale as a progressive movement, and unions could have rallied behind it, by the way, private and public sector, to say loudly, one, we need to extend them, or even strategically, at least we need to keep those corporate rates, right, at 7% and not them sink back to 4.7. So we just missed like five strategic opportunities as a movement because we are slightly demobilized. That's been the key thing that the right is trying to do, is keep the movement confused, confused about taxes, confused about unions, confused about government unions, confused about labor bosses, when what they're actually doing is creating austerity and decimating very vital social programs. And he is going to put that program on steroids, both the attack on public sector unions and the unraveling of Illinois' social sector. He is on a twin parallel track. The guy has a train, it has left the station. And the problem is what our movement's response is, which has been just horrific so far.
Well, let's talk a bit more about his agenda. The child care program you described, how did it come to be, and what were the unions that were involved in producing it?
In Illinois, there is a terrific local union that's a member of SEIU nationally. And, you know, unions are not monolithic anywhere in this country, both within their unions and generally. So in Illinois, there's a very strong local union of SEIU that has long blazed the trail to have women of color, mostly, that's women who work in home care and child care, become unionized. They were effective at doing that. They unionized the sector. By the way, they expanded childcare so that literally at this point, 160,000 low-income women get very high-quality childcare, something that we are desperate for, not just in Illinois, but all over the country. So Rauner's come in, and he's got a sharp, sort of like the right wing does, he has a sharp power analysis of the whole situation. And he sees, yeah, well, unions actually grew in Illinois in the last few years, which was, of course, against the sort of national trends. And when the unions grew, they created a sort of robust childcare program that actually helped working mothers, which allows low-income women to go to work and know that their kids are being cared for well. So he comes in with like laser precision, as the right wing does, unlike our side, right? We elect governors and it takes like 2 years. They set up a commission, they think about doing something, maybe they raise a couple of wages. This guy, in less than a month in office, comes in, unravels a desperately needed tax increase, immediately takes down the amount of taxes he's going to pay, immediately takes down taxes on corporations, manufactures a crisis and says, I'm going to knock out childcare, I'm going to knock out social spending, I'm going to knock out the schools, I'm going to knock out everything. But what he strategically messages is just as he's going to go after labor movement bosses, right? Which endears him to the right, distracts the entire country, when what he's doing is unraveling badly needed social programs in Illinois. That's how we're going to get to sort of an austerity level that makes it feel like, again, Greece, but with really a very different weather in Chicago.
Yes, very opposite. The polar opposite, you might say. What is his agenda with the unions? What's he plan to do? How's he plan to wreck them?
You know, essentially, ironically, it was Illinois, which the right wing is sort of loving this right now. It was a huge court case last summer called Harris v. Quinn. Very, very important. What Harris v. Quinn, and Quinn had been the governor of Illinois up until Rauner just won, right? So we're going to have, I think he wants to get his name in a Supreme Court case too, right? Because he felt badly that a Democrat did. So in Harris v. Quinn, we had a case that was brought in Illinois by some of the same right-wing forces that elected Rauner, by the way. You can do a power structure analysis map straight to the same forces. They manufactured a case to get to the Supreme Court called Harris v. Quinn, Harris being a home care worker, who was part of the organized right wing, who objected to paying any money at all to unions. The Harris v. Quinn case opened up achieving something that the right wing has not been able to achieve in places like New York and California and Washington, what we think of as the blue states in America, where lots of money roll into the national coffers for national elections, by the way. And Harris v. Quinn did this by this very weird maneuver of saying, we're going to create a category called partial public employees. And partial public employees, by the way, are mostly black people and women, and they work in home care and child care. And so the first leg of the attack on unions nationally, done through Illinois, was done last summer. So Harris v. Quinn says, home care and child care workers, they're not really workers, they're only partial workers. No surprise there, right? Because they're women and women of color, and they're doing work in the home. This is the as old as patriarchy goes, this debate. Okay, so they then say, in some bizarre, perverse logic in the Supreme Court, that partial government workers don't have to keep paying what's called an agency fee, which, now this is all Byzantine on purpose, an agency fee in the labor movement means, and it's been long recognized law under called the Abood ruling from 1978, that government workers don't have to be forced to pay the portion of their membership dues that go to political causes. So this has been going on since 1978 across the country. So what they did last summer was they laid the groundwork to undo this. They first said, well, home care and daycare workers aren't really workers. They're only sort of partial people. I mean, partial employees. So they don't really have to pay any agency fee at all. That's a huge gutting of a base of both income and power in the labor movement. What Rauner just did was, in a single act, more like acting like a monarch or a king, sort of issued a decree in his executive order, and his invective sounded like he was a king, issuing a new decree. He actually said, I'm not even going to wait for the Supreme Court to rule. I'm going to make a single declaration in Illinois that actually that ruling is going to extend to every single so-called government worker in Illinois. And not only am I going to make that law, which he knows right now is technically illegal, I'm going to create an escrow account. I'm going to start withdrawing all the money from that would go to the unions. So he's going to starve their coffers preemptively. And he's brought in a high-powered legal team to take his case on a fast track to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in some ways, by taking the union money and putting it into an escrow account right now and starving them illegally of the money that they're owed, he's sort of drawing, he's setting up a fast track to the Supreme Court. So this is like a sophisticated, well-thought-out strategy, as the right wing is always engaged in, and it's to both destroy unions and to destroy every social service program that the state of Illinois has. That's really what's happening in Illinois. And what's amazing is the sort of, honestly, the sort of relative silence of many players in the union movement and in the progressive sector. That's part of what's so disturbing about what's happening in Illinois right now.
Let's talk about his strategy. It has a brutal efficiency to it. Kills two birds with one stone in that it will cut spending if they can cut wages and cut programs,
yes,
which would allow tax cuts for his constituency. And the other side, it undermines a very important organized opposition to the Republican agenda, the public sector unions. It's really a brilliant strategy from his point of view, isn't it?
Yeah, it's totally brilliant. And it's what they've been doing all across the country. And part of what needs to happen is there's this sort of false discussion, this sort of false dichotomy that's been happening in the social change, progressive movement, labor movement for the last, you know, sort of like 5 or 6 years, which is that we sort of create an echo chamber for the right wing and the corporate right in particular by agreeing with them that there's some difference between the public sector and the so-called private sector. And, you know, part of what I have been trying to articulate everywhere I can is that this is both wrong. We essentially have one economy. We don't have two different economies. We have a single economy. And we need to stop echoing the right wing by suggesting that there's some massive difference between government workers and private sector workers, because their agenda doesn't recognize that, both in how many subsidies the corporations take from government and in the swiftness with which their strategy has been executed to de-unionize the entire country, which, again, then only facilitates their agenda to continue cutting every single program that we've won from the 1930s on and every single law we passed from the 1930s and the 1960s and 70s on. They are rolling the agenda back. Their agenda is so clear. They're so precise, and we are so muddled and so confused and so easily divided and unraveled by what they're doing. And we have to get clear about our own power structure analysis and about how we're going to take these guys on.
I'm speaking with the organizer and writer, Jane McAlevey. Now, there are some differences between public and private sector. One is that you know, the union density in the public sector is, what, 4 or 5 times that of the private. So this is a site of relative strength for the labor movement compared to the private sector.
Yeah, but again, I'm rejecting it. I actually think, Doug, we have to stop using the language. We have one big economy in the United States, and the corporations pimp more money out of it than anyone else does right now. And when we play into that message, the idea that there are, that they're creating a message that there's sort of two economies, not that there's two sectors. And I think when we use that language, we are playing into a strategy that says they're different. I mean, essentially what they did was, they've have been coming after unions in this country for a long time. Why? Whatever complaints we have about the union sector, and I think people know that I've got several, it is unions in this country who created the workers, not unions. It's workers through their organizations in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s who created the context for the working class in this country to have power, who created the context for the kind of progressive laws that we passed from the 30s through the early 70s until the Great Unraveling began. And so what they did first in the 70s was take a scalpel to the heavily unionized sector, steel, auto manufacturing, et cetera, by creating global trade rules that put American workers who worked in manufacturing, I'm not going to call it a sector, that's the point, Workers who worked in manufacturing and factories and auto and steel, et cetera, were suddenly put in direct competition with workers in repressed countries who made a dollar. Then the message affected the right wing went to, hey, these workers are so non-competitive and overpaid. We have to do something about that. They're overpaid and overcompensated. So they decimated one entire sector of that was heavily unionized in this country, one entire group of workers who were heavily unionized in this thing called the U.S. economy. And now they're coming after what's left, which is among workers who work in public service, that's things like home care and child care and more, and people who take care of our parks and our recreation and take care of the environment, which the right hates too. You know, all these kinds of workers are unionized at a 40% level, whereas workers in manufacturing and steel, et cetera, you know, we're down to about 6% coverage in those kind of fields. And the strategy now is to say, hey, these workers are overcompensated. We need to do something about that. They get way too much, right? So I think it's myth-making on the part of the right, and it's message and frame strategy when they talk about these two very different sectors. I just think we have to reject it. We have a U.S. economy, and mostly we have a very effective right wing with the power structure analysis attacking the sectors. That's it. They're attacking every worker. They're attacking every social program. And they're unraveling every signal gain that we've made. And they're doing it by systematically deunionizing the country. That's what's been happening for really 40 years.
But there's another crucial difference in that the recognition or derecognition of private sector unions is done by bosses who don't particularly care about being popular. In the public sector, it is elected officials who are ultimately responsible, and they do supposedly care about being popular because they have to get reelected. Why are unions, public sector unions, so unable to mobilize popular support, and how can the right get away with it?
Well, look, I don't think it's just public sector unions. I think that we've had a crisis for many years that parallels this, and that's why the right wing is using sort of a precision tool to drill into these unions right now. On the labor movement side, regardless of sector, because again, I think we have to stop using it, but inside of trade unions, there's been an internal demobilization strategy, ironically, inside of unions, right, where we've sort of replace the idea of having a power structure analysis that led with that workers are the most important part of our power, of our weapon, right, to win in this country. And we've demobilized our own base inside of the union movement. We've sort of replaced the idea that workers in huge numbers, when they stand united, can take action to sort of put a check on this crazy right wing that wants austerity all through America. We've demobilized the most powerful weapon we have, which is the workers themselves. And we've kind of replaced them with the idea that narrative change matters, with the idea that high-paid consultants in the labor movement and lots of staff can kind of do the work on behalf of workers. And we just need a PR strategy, and we need to just sort of like sit down and find the reasonable capitalist and have a chit-chat with them. And, you know, many of us for years have called this, you know, engaging labor snuggle, not labor struggle, right? Like, we just need to find some friends. We need to work with our market forces. You know, we need to sort of reinvent the idea that we can create Henry Fords today and we can find some capitalists who we can partner with who will just decide, hey, we're actually good guys and we want to pay our workers more. That's not going to happen. If it ever did happen, it's not what happened. What happened was that workers in this country, you know, raised hell, exercised their power, went on strike with a lot of public support in this country. The one place where we saw a massive strike that was very successful in the last couple of years, not surprisingly, was Illinois, in the mighty strike that the Chicago teachers led in 2012. It's not a surprise that the place that we had the most effective use of the strike weapon in this country in really decades was in the state of Illinois. It's not a surprise that that is where both Rahm Emanuel, he's a Democrat, he clearly didn't care about whether he was popular or not, and the Republican now, Bruce Rauner, are essentially on the same agenda to decimate their teachers' unions and their unions in the state of Illinois. Why? Because those unions are actually the last hope that black people, working class people, that everyone in Illinois has to sort of save the public schools, save the child care system, you know, save public transit, and we go right down the line of the things that matter to every single worker in this country.
Now, this is to some degree a rerun of Scott Walker in Wisconsin a few years ago. What, if anything, did the labor movement learn from that or not learn from it?
You know, I think this is the painful part of the conversation. I think we're not learning fast enough. And there's been a whole sort of bevy of literature articles, stories, books that have come out since Scott Walker was elected in Wisconsin that, again, I think sort of parrot and echo this dangerous message that the public sector and the private sectors are different within the union movement. So I'm not sure that we're learning fast enough. I think we've learned a little bit. I think that we have, you know, we can see we've got some intellectuals like Robert Reich, and we've got Paul Krugman in the New York Times and others decrying inequality. And we've got people saying that there's a link between, you know, the growing levels of disgusting inequality in America and the decimation of the unions. But the emphasis has been on the decimation of the unions who worked in auto, steel manufacturing, et cetera. And there's not a sharp fight back or a sharp message on the part of progressives or even leftists about the fact that it is the 40% unionized public service workers that have become the most strategic part of our economy, the most strategic workers that we need to throw down with everything we have, build a fortress around, and protect right now. We're not clear on it. I think it's because we're so confused about how to talk about taxes in our movement. We're so confused about how to talk about the state that we sort of can't figure out how to react when a governor like Rauner, or a guy like Rauner who made $60 million last year, whose agenda is austerity, stands up and says, government workers are different, and so, you know, we can deunionize them because that's what I'm decreeing. There has been some reaction, but quite honestly, there has not been a unified reaction in the way that we should have had this week from lots of folks to say, stop this guy dead in his tracks, build a fortress around Illinois right now. And on top of that, I have to point out to you that if you go online and look at the unions that have endorsed Rahm Emanuel right now in the mayor's race, you'll see massive confusion inside the union movement. So if you ask what have unions learned, it's a little challenged. We have a ton of unions, many of which known to be quote unquote progressive, who have actually come out and endorsed Rahm Emanuel. So we're all in Illinois right now. We're still in the state of Illinois. It was Rahm Emanuel who first started the austerity attack by trying to kill public education. That's our public schools in Chicago in the last couple of years, sort of mirroring Arne Duncan and the national attack, right? These guys are all related. Obama's from Illinois and from Chicago. Arne Duncan at the national level, who's decimating education, is from Chicago and Illinois. Rahm Emanuel was in the White House. He's now back in the office. So it's like Democrats and Republicans, right? This is a bipartisan effort to decimate collectively sort of the programs that we hold near and dear as progressives, like public schools, childcare, and more. And there are unions in Illinois, more unions than not, who actually have endorsed Rahm Emanuel in the current mayor's race after the guy tried to systematically destroy not just the teachers' union. That was just a way to get at the privatization of the public school system in Chicago, Illinois. So Illinois needs to be a focus for the entire progressive movement now. And every single union that endorsed Rahm Emanuel, shame on them. Their leadership nationally and locally should be held accountable for the mass confusion they have in cutting a deal with this crazy guy, Rahm Emanuel.
We're listening to an interview with Jane McAlevey, the labor organizer and writer. Her article, We Need Syriza in Illinois, is on the Nation magazine's website, thenation.com. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood. More Jane McAlevey after some music. Thank you. was the beginning of Beethoven's Archduke Trio, performed by Daniel Barenboim, Jacqueline Dupré, and Itzhak Perlman. And now on to part two of my interview with Jane McAlevey. I want to come back to the ROM issue in a second, but there are probably a lot of regular folks in Illinois who say, well, you know, my wages are under pressure, I have no benefits to speak of, these public sector workers have it too good, the hell with them. How do you deal with that kind of reaction?
Precisely by saying two things. One is there is no private sector, there is no public sector. So I have to say that this strategy evolved not from, you know, sort of me sitting in a little office. It evolved from my time as a union leader in the state of Nevada. And I just want to walk backwards for a minute. In the state of Nevada, which is already and always has been what's called a right-to-work state, where union members don't have to join the union, in the union that I helped lead there, we had both the so-called public sector and the so-called private sector in one union. That's unusual, really, today. So we had county workers, which is the largest sector of workers in the state of Illinois in the union, and we also had so-called private sector workers. I want to walk this clock back to what we did. In 2004, when I came into Nevada to start working with the union, there was the same message effect we see right now. We had a Democratic county executive named Tom Riley, who created the message that Rauner and Rahm Emanuel are now echoing, and we're a full decade later. Okay, so in 2004, in the state of Nevada, which is known to be a libertarian state, where Harry Reid, you know, the Senate Majority Leader for many years until, by the way, recently, where the senator from Nevada, his, you know, billboards in Nevada when I got there were so interesting to me because they said, independent like Nevada, right? It's a highly libertarian state. There is no state income tax in Nevada. So the Democratic county executive who wanted to gut pensions and save some money and not have to deal with the question of taxes had a jihad going against, quote unquote, the government workers. And he had a message. So I arrive and this message that we're now seeing in Illinois is already playing in Nevada. The first thing we understood we had to do was help educate our own rank and file trade union base in both people who worked in the so-called private sector in hospitals and in the so-called public sector, which was in the county office buildings. We had to first create unity between the workforce. We had to do mass educationals. We went and talked to thousands of rank and file workers, and we showed PowerPoint slideshows, and we said, this is a false dichotomy. Every so-called private sector worker in this union in Nevada who worked for giant private sector, as they call it, hospitals like HCA, most of your money is actually coming directly through Medicaid and Medicare, et cetera, and through massive direct subsidies to the healthcare sector that take place in the form of pharmaceuticals, huge research grants. So step one of the strategy was to have our own base, was to create an educational program to have our own that was feisty and that was bold and that was challenging and that challenged our own members to think differently, right, about the relationship between the two. We had to first start with our own base. We had to build unity that this was a false construct being created by right-wing pricks who wanted to destroy the whole country. And that took about a year. We did almost nothing but a radical mass popular education program among the existing rank and file of the union. Once the members understood that this was a false dichotomy and a strategy that was being used to decimate the last group of workers who had real pensions, who had a real right to retire, who had a decent health care package in their collective bargaining process. Once we had unity of purpose among the rank and file workers, we then took that program statewide and we became the messengers to undo the myth that there was overpaid workers and underpaid workers. What there was a bunch of workers getting screwed, and the last workers who still had it okay, we had to defend them because we had to bring the workers who were getting far too less back up to the standard of the workers who had lost their pensions in the private sector. And that's what we set out to do in Nevada, and by God, we did it. We actually recreated enough power to win through collective bargaining defined benefit pension plans in the private sector. That we literally went on a reverse course in Nevada and began to win. So it's possible to do this. And that's why my reaction to the lack of strategy nationally and in Illinois right now is so strong. We did it in a very right-wing state with a very conservative culture. And we need to take that strategy nationally, which is you start by investing heavily in a real rank-and-file education program. You roll up your sleeves and take on the question of taxation in this country. You talk about what taxes mean. You talk about who's benefiting the most from taxes, which is corporations. And you lay out a clear strategy that this is a comprehensive strategy to destroy American workers, period. They don't care what sector they're in. That's the kind of strategy that we need nationally.
Returning to the Rahm question, why are unions endorsing him?
Jesus. Self-interest, deal cutting, and a lack of real understanding that he's going to come for them next. That's what we sort of miss here.
Isn't it obvious that he really wants to go after everyone? I mean, how can they miss this?
You know, look, here's what these guys do. They come to a private sector union or to a public sector union to divide public sector from public. You know, this is all about just dividing and conquering. It may be obvious, but when he stands up and says and articulates the same crap that we're articulating in a bunch of books put out by supposed progressives in the last few years, hey, I'm for the private sector. You know what Ronald Reagan said? The same thing that Rahm Emanuel is saying. Ronald Reagan articulated all through the 1980s when he first came in, I support the right of the private sector workers to have unions. It's just those air traffic controllers and public sector workers. They're different, so they shouldn't have a union. This shit is old as Ronald Reagan, and we play right into it. So Rahm Emanuel is using the same message as Ronald Reagan, and he is still dividing the unions among themselves. That's what's happening in Illinois right now, and it's to all of our detriment because it has national implications.
And you said the broad progressive community's analysis has been rather flawed. What is this and what's wrong with it?
Jesus, first of all, we don't have a power analysis. I mean, part of the problem in the broad progressive movement is that, you know, in some ways harkening back to C. Wright Mills and sort of the new left in the 60s, you know, we gave up on workers. Like, we decided that there was something wrong with unions. They were a little hierarchical. There were some problems with them. And so we literally took a well-articulated value of Karl Marx's, that workers are a particularly powerful agent of change. That was a theory of power, that workers had the agency to make great changes. And guess what? It was working. For a couple of generations, that's exactly what happened in this country. Then the 60s come along, and we decide that we're going to like anoint like white, well-educated liberals and college students as the agent of change. It failed. We have to go back to the basic core idea that we need a mass base in this country. And absent a mass base, we are going to continue to get decimated. And the mass base is the workers. They actually are very capable of winning these fights. I saw it in Nevada. We've recreated it in several parts of this country, and we just saw it in Chicago with the Chicago Teachers Union strike. 30,000 workers both enjoyed massive popular support and exercised the strike weapon, the big critique by lots of progressives about, you know, unions in the last, whatever, couple of decades, is that, you know, we all bemoan not using the strike weapon. Well, the strike weapon was put to very effective use in the state of Illinois, the same state we're talking about, in the city of Chicago, with mostly black workers. And how, not only did it get put to, not only did we revisit the strike weapon as a massive, powerful tool exercised by workers, that'd be the working class, the teachers and the educators of Chicago, but they did so and they were able to sustain unprecedented public and community support. Why? Because they did exactly what unions are meant to do, which is to speak about broad class interests and to defend the class, not the narrowest conception of who their members are. So when we return, as we just saw in Chicago with the teacher strike, when unions return to both being bold, to exercising militancy, we can reuse the strike weapon. It's essential. We cannot use the strike weapon if we're disconnected from our rank and file members and if we're disconnected from the broader public. In the case of the Chicago Teachers Union, a much more recent example than the work that I had the pleasure of leading in Nevada, it just reinforces that we can do this, right? Here's two good examples. What the Chicago teachers did was they said, in fact, labor's job is to defend broad class interests. And that's what this strike is about. We're defending public schools. And they didn't just fight for their contract. They have been fighting Rahm Emanuel and the forces of Rahm Emanuel and Arne Duncan since the mid-2000s in Chicago to defend the public school system against the imposition of charters and against mass closures of public schools. So this idea that we can't use strikes is wrong. We can. We've got some terrific examples of it. And it is predicated on the idea that labor remembers. that our job is to fight for the class. And I have one more thing to say about this, which is there's just like we have a lot of confusion among progressives and the left about whether or not there's two sectors, the public and private, and which one's more important. I want to be super clear. The most important sector right now, the strategic sector left in this economy, is the public sector workers right now. That's one. And two, there's this idea, we don't really need unions anymore. You know, we can just sort of like puff up low-wage workers and we can win a bunch of wage increases through ballot initiatives. And what's missing is a strategic power analysis. If all workers ever needed in America was a wage every couple of years, was a salary increase that kept them in a lesser status of poverty, which is all these wage increases are doing, but they didn't need power, which is what you build when you build collective power through a union, right? A union builds collective power. We need power because workers don't just need a raise. They need childcare. They need affordable housing. They need the power to stop crazy gentrification plans. They need the power to lift themselves up in every way possible. They need good public schools. That requires power. So the confusion going on in this country that we can let the unions get decimated, the agents of collective power building, and replace that with public relations strategies and occasional ballot initiatives that lift raises from like dire poverty to I'm still in poverty as a worker, it's wrongheaded. It's just, we're just going to keep losing if we keep doing sort of the same thing that we've been doing for the last few years.
I'm speaking with the organizer and writer, Jane McAlevey.
You mentioned that new left critique of unions, the one born in the 60s, as being, you know, sort of old-fashioned, hierarchical, agents of a labor aristocracy, white, male. Some of this lingers today. A lot of the contemporary left is very critical of centralized organizations, hierarchical organizations. You know, it's the opposite of an affinity group. So how do you answer that critique from some of our colleagues on the left?
Yeah, I say two things. There's a huge confusion between internal democracy and horizontalism, just for starters, right? So it is absolutely true that we need to be very critical of unions. But by the way, it isn't just unions. Look at the philanthropic sector. Look at the environmental movement. Every single part of our social change apparatus has sort of a non-democratic, internally feeble sort of model right now. And again, I want to contrast that to the living examples that we still have, which exist right now in Chicago in the teachers union. They're trying to do it right now in Los Angeles in the teachers union. There's a movement in Massachusetts. There are internal democracy movements and unions all over this country. And progressives need to stand up and understand the difference between a union that's not democratic and a union that's democratic. And we need to help be part of the, you know, echo effect to call for more internal union democracy, but not just in unions, everywhere in our movement, women's movement, whatever, environmental movement, blah, blah, blah. So there's a huge difference between democracy and hierarchy. So, and I want to articulate that. We have examples, living examples today, of tremendous unions. They're not really at the national level. They're more at the local level. And Chicago and the teachers are a good example. We have SEIU locals in the state of Connecticut and in the state of Washington, 1190, the old locals that came out of what was called the healthcare sector, inside the organization. And here's why they're still democratic. They have rules that say things like this. They tie the salaries of the elected leadership in the union and the staff to the salaries of the workers with whom they are engaged. They run strikes regularly because the best test of whether or not that the workers are mobilized together and unified and have a democratic organization is, are they willing to all walk off the job in a very high-risk action together? They have internal mechanisms that work to keep the unions democratic. That's what's been decimated from sort of the national unions. Even our most celebrated, quote-unquote, progressives, right? We saw in terms of what happened in California with SEIU, what happened, frankly, in Nevada with SEIU. We've seen in many examples that the sort of national level drive inside of the unions is sort of over-centralization. It is a lack of democracy. But we've got to understand what a democratic trade union looks like, and we've got to fight for them. Because if we are not fighting for democratic trade unions like the Chicago Teachers Union, we have no strategy. Collective power is what we have to build, and it actually can best be done by reinvigorating a democratic strong internal trade union movement.
Now, what do you make of Sam Gindin's argument that the labor movement needs a revivified left and vice versa, but it needs a left that sort of stands inside and outside at once to act as historical memory and offer theoretical clarity, so that the decline of the labor movement and the decline of left go hand in hand, and any reversal would have to be one that happens together as well?
I think he's absolutely right. I completely agree. There's no question that he's right. When our unions were strong, it's because we had a strong left, right? That is the history of the 1930s. When McCarthyism decimated the left, that's when the unions then ossified. That's when you've got the New Left critique. So the New Left critique, I mean, I wasn't there. I wasn't born. But, you know, the way I read it is they sort of missed that the agents of capital had imposed McCarthyism to do serious damage to what were red-led and very smart, very progressive, and very powerful trade unions, right? If you look at the history of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, and there's a really good book on this called Left Out, and they actually identify that most of the unions inside of the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, that most of the unions inside of the CIO in the 1930s and 40s had exactly the kind of union constitutions that I just described that they currently have in some local unions in this country still, which is that they had internal constitutions that created the space to have high participation, more horizontal, more rank and file led unions. That's why we created McCarthyism. McCarthyism came in and decimated the 18 unions that in the 1930s and 40s were actually run very democratically, where the rank and file workers were in control of their unions. So none of this is an accident, just like it's not an accident today. It's that we don't understand this. So McCarthyism took out the best organizers in the trade union movement, and by organizers, I mean rank and file leaders, staff. It's a general term for me, right? Organizers mean the people who wake up every day to build and grow our power. That's what organizers are. It doesn't matter if they're paid to do it full time or if they're leaders. The organizers in the labor movement, who were Reds, were decimated by McCarthyism, and we're left now with a shell of them. But every place that we see current examples where we've got progressive leading progressives, real radicals leading a trade union, we see a democratic union, and we have to rally behind them. And they exist right now in Chicago, and they exist in, you know, it's a long list, frankly, but I'd have to go sort of state by state and local by local. But Gindin is right. What the problem with what Gindin is saying and what we have been trying to debate out a little bit is it's sort of chicken and egg. It's like, it's a little tautological. How do you do it? Right. So we need better unions that help create a more expanded, radicalized working class, but we need an expanded left to help foment, you know, it's a difficult discussion. It's the right discussion. It's absolutely the right discussion. It's just complicated about how do we rebuild either in this country right now, but we can do it.
Well, you know, the left is small and weak, but not non-existent. But there are a lot of people who populate it who are really indifferent to or even hostile to unions. I mean, how do you break through that?
That is the central problem. And I think that we have to have a really serious discussion. Again, I mean, what I want to say to people is, look, leftists and trade unions who are smart, who are not overly sectarian, that's the sort of crowd that, you know, bemoans the fact that we don't have strikes and then doesn't realize that the Chicago Teachers Union strike, those mostly black women workers who went on strike, just did the boldest thing we've seen in decades in this country. And they're not rallying around it. So we're so filled with internal contradictions right now. So I think the question that I think is fundamental every day is, what is your theory of power? Do you have a theory of power? Because real leftists have a theory of power still. I don't think any of us have surrendered the idea that, in fact, workers are the agent of change. The question is, how do we recreate the space for unions to build collective power? Collective power is the answer to the power analysis crisis. Like, there's no shortcut to how it is that we have to build collective power. And to build collective power, we have to get around the idea that just having protests is sufficient. Just protesting isn't sufficient. We have to learn how to govern in order to sustain the gains that we win. Because we de-emphasized collective power, because we de-emphasized, you know, understanding how to govern, we just lost like 80 years of gains in this country by the Voting Rights Act being destroyed, by the rolling back of Taft-Hartley, by the rise of inequality. So I think we have to anchor very clear discussions in this country around one central question every day, everywhere, in every workshop, in every talk. I think we have to ask someone, whatever you just said is interesting. Tell me your theory of power. I want you to start by articulating your theory of power, because if you don't have a theory of power and you don't then have a model for power structure analysis and you don't then have a strategy that flows from a theory of power, what are you talking about, right? Some of us have a theory of power. It goes back to the 1930s, and it says, in fact, we need a mass and broad popular base. We need something called collective power. We have to have a strategy that helps move individual people in this country from thinking like individuals to moving towards collective power. That's how we win. How do you do that? Well, the strategy was that we actually have to go have mass radical political education and conversations with millions of people called America's workers. And that's a broad class, right? That's everything from, you know, people who we call poor right now, the unemployed, you know, including low-wage workers. But we also have to have a strategic conversation. What's the best way to do it? Who has the most capacity to act? How quickly can they act? By the way, teachers are one of the most important constituencies right now to rally around, because teachers as a class have the capacity to understand what's happening to them, which is why we're seeing such a huge rebellion inside of the teachers' unions right now. They understand they're stable enough, their salary is stable enough, they've gotten, you know, a kind of education that makes it so that they can quickly understand, oh my God, this attack isn't about me getting paid too much. This is an attack on public education, right? So the central question is, do you have a theory of power? We should be driving that question every day, all over the movement. And we should be calling out people who don't have one. Because saying that hyped up public relations where we prop up a worker at a press conference is a theory of power is just a bunch of bull.
I think a lot of people on the left have a theory of power, which they've inherited from Lord Acton, which is that power corrupts and they want to stay pure and stay away from it.
Yeah. Again, that like the argument about Robert Michel's it's both true that we have a problem with learning how to govern our organizations well. It's equally true that we've got fantastic examples historically and today that say we actually can build organizations that are democratic. And we to think that individuals versus aggregating people into a collective structure can exercise power up against guys like Rauner, who makes $60 million a year and put $27 million into their own elections, means we are on a fast track to losing every last thing we have in this country. It's just bull.
Okay, then finally, say Jane McAlevey was given command of the fight against Rauner. What would General McAlevey do?
First of all, rally the entire country. But it's almost too hard to say it in a couple of seconds. But the first thing I would do is start the internal conversation in Illinois, just the way we did in Nevada, right away. Which is the base to stop him is in Illinois. Right away, we've got to have a conversation going worker to worker among workers that says there's no difference between these sectors. They come for one, they come for all, because that is what they're doing. And we have to build the base right there. So mass radical political education, like literally stop in Nevada, we just stopped the business of the union, literally, and rolled out a PowerPoint educational and pulled everyone into giant meetings across the entire organization, across every sector. And so we started with mass radical political education about what was really going on. Guess what? That's exactly what the Chicago teachers did, by the way, when the radicals won in 2010. They went on to a massive internal political education program that said, do you think the next contract is about a 1% raise, or do you think it's about whether or not we have public schools in Illinois? So we need bold action. We need bold, honest, strategic conversations right away. We need to expose what the real Rauner agenda is, not hide behind it. We need to educate our own base first and foremost. The step they skipped in Wisconsin, Ohio, and everywhere. We have to do massive, internal, radical political education about what the agenda really is. And I would start by asking the Chicago Teachers Union for their own internal educational materials, because I've seen them and they're damn good, right? So, and within 1 year, in Chicago, they did the same thing that we did in Nevada in 2004, which is in 1 year of stopping all engines and saying, we have to have a radical conversation about what the agenda really is, about the people running this country. And in 1 year, they rebuilt their union. By 2 years later, they were ready for a massive strike. It doesn't take that long. We have examples that we can do this very quickly when we're focused and smart. So that's That's General McAlevey's thing. You know, first thing is look at what Chicago teachers did, replicate it immediately in every single union in the state of Illinois. That's one. Two, this is as much a problem of the Democratic Party, if not more, as it is an issue of the Republicans. We're focused on Rauner now because it's easier for the labor aristocracy to be like, oh, look what the Republican governor is doing. It's Rahm Emanuel. So step two of the plan is that shame on every union right now in Chicago that has endorsed that son of a bitch. Every single national union leader should be criticized for what's happening, what they're allowing to happen in Illinois, which is a massive divide and conquer with Rahm Emanuel. And three, we have to, you know, basically take the same discussion national. We have to have radical political education about what's really happening and why it's happening, and then resurface the discussion at every level about what's your theory of power, because there isn't a theory of power right now. And if we are honest about needing a power theory, which we desperately need right now, it's a theory of collective action. It is not a theory of individual public relations gimmicks. It's a theory of collective power. We have to fight this out fast and win, or we're going to lose everything before we even know it.
That was Jane McAlevey, labor organizer and writer. Her article, We Need Syriza in Illinois, is on the Nation's website, thenation.com. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go at this, the Stooges singing about power. Till next week, bye. Try to tell me.